This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, November 21st, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. Sentencing reform has languished for years, but there is recent hope that long sentences driven by mandatory minimums may be on the wane. In a recent edition of Cato Connects, Molly Gill of Families Against Mandatory Minimums and Adam Bates of Cato discuss new legislative prospects for criminal justice reform.
President Obama has been making a pretty big deal out of the fact that 6,000 inmates are going to be released out of the federal system, but is that entirely appropriate for the president to be trumping up this release of 6,000 people, Molly?
As much as he might like to take credit for this, it was actually an independent bipartisan agency, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, that set this in motion over a year ago. They looked at the sentencing guidelines, which apply in all federal cases, including drug cases, and decided that these sentences had always been actually just a little too high and decided to shorten them.
Okay. So of the 6,000 prisoners to be released, many of them are out of prison already and are on some other form of incarceration. And as you know, 600,000 people are returning from state and federal prisons every year. This is a U.S. Sentencing Commission policy that is complying with a statutory mandate to do this kind of work. What about Congress having been able to have reversed this policy?
Sure. I think some people think that this is the commission going off the reservation and doing something wild and crazy, and it's actually within their mandate. They're supposed to ensure that prison population is managed over the years, and right now we have horrendous overcrowding. So these reductions were put through a rulemaking process. There was a notice and comment period for the public to respond. Congress had a six-month window where they could reject what the commission was doing. Congress did nothing. They had no hearings. And so this went into effect, essentially, with no objections from Congress.
So but there are objections from Congress, some members of Congress. Now, after the fact, what are the complaints?
Well, I think it's fear that you're letting 6,000 dangerous criminals back on the street and they're all going to hurt us. And unfortunately, there's some misinformation that's gotten out there. These are all drug offenders. These aren't bank robbers. These aren't other violent offenders. There are very few violent offenders in the federal system to begin with. These are all drug offenders. They've all been individually vetted by a court before they got out. And you can only get out early if the court says that you're not a public safety risk. Also, they're only getting about, on average, 2 years knocked off of their sentences, which means they've still done about 9 years in prison on average. And all of these people were coming home anyway.
It's something that you note here, and Adam, feel free to jump in. If there are 2.3 million people in state and federal prison in the United States of America right now, you say that 600,000 people are returning home
every single year.
Every single year. That's almost mind-boggling in terms of the churn in state and federal prisons.
Absolutely. I mean, 6,000 is a drop in the bucket. Actually, a third of these people, 2,000 of them, have already been sent over to ICE for deportation. So we're really talking about 4,000 people trickling back home, being spread out over 50 states. The biggest recipient of these returning citizens will be Texas. They're getting about 350 people heading back to Texas borders. So I think that this 6,000 release has been hyped up as something that is not quite as frightening as some would maybe like it to be.
When I think, Molly can correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason it's 6,000 in this bulk is because when the Sentencing Commission made the reform retroactive, there was a mandatory one-year buffer between the release, so nobody could be released until November 1st of this year. And so the reason it's 6,000 rather than a steady supply is because there was this hard deadline. Otherwise, many of these people would have already been released, and the releases would have been more spread out. So I don't think it's going to be this kind of bulk release. But as Molly mentioned, it's not really even a bulk release spread out over the entire country.
Right. And it's also not taking people out of prison and dropping them on a curb in the middle of America somewhere, too. All of these people have already spent months in halfway houses or on home arrest, making that slow transition that's supervised back into the community. All of these people are going to have lengthy periods of supervised release where they have to report to a probation officer, sometimes for years, even when they are out of that halfway house or home confinement. So certainly we are going to be keeping tabs on these people.
Now, there are as I understand it, four major pieces of legislation that are that could be the sentencing reform, but it's most likely going to be the Grassley reform in the Senate and in the House. Who is it?
It's Chairman Bob Goodlatte from Virginia of the House Judiciary Committee just introduced the Sentencing Reform Act, which is essentially identical to the Senate bill put forward by Senator Grassley from Iowa, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We are expecting the House Judiciary Committee to mark up Mr. Goodlatte's bill as early as next week. And, you know, both of these bills would are a good first step, certainly could go a lot further.
Okay. So of the other people who have been pushing this issue, Durbin of Illinois, Lee of Utah, Rand Paul of Kentucky, and Pat Leahy?
Pat Leahy of Vermont
are the,
as well.
Are some of the other folks that have been pushing mm-hmm. this, as well as Jim Sensenbrenner mm-hmm. and Bobby Scott, also in the House. All of these are a Democrat and a Republican right. deciding to get together to do this sort of thing. But in terms of the bills that are have the most juice, or I should say have the most committee chairman signed on to them, talk about the sentencing reform in both of those bills.
Sure. Both bills would reduce probably what I would say are the harshest of the mandatory minimums. So right now there's a mandatory life without parole for a third drug offense. That gets knocked down to 25 years. There's 20 years for a second drug offense. That goes down to 15 years. There are a few gun possession offenses that carry very long mandatory minimums. Those are being cut. But no mandatory minimums are being eliminated. Everyone is still going to prison. Some of the other reforms include giving judges some more flexibility in the drug mandatory sentencing context to go below the mandatory minimum for nonviolent offenders with minimal criminal records. And so that's a positive development. It's restoring some more flexibility to the courts in a system that really has been co-opted by prosecutors able to charge mandatory minimums for the last 30 years.
All right. In both bills, it would retroactively apply the Fair Sentencing Act to current inmates. What does that mean?
Sure. Back in 2010, Congress fixed really sort of a nonsensical distinction in federal law between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, which are chemically the same drug. Essentially, you needed a very tiny amount of crack cocaine, very large amount of powder cocaine. You got the same mandatory minimum sentence. Congress sort of recognizes—
And they appeal to different income cohorts, we'll put it that way, because it crack cocaine is generally a cheap drug, and powder cocaine is generally a very expensive drug.
Sure. And, of course, there's some racial disparity that was resulting as well from that price distinction. And, you know, at one point, nearly 90% of crack cocaine offenders were African American, and getting these much, much longer sentences. So Congress reduced that disparity in the drug weights. And the problem was they forgot that everyone was already in prison doing these unfair sentences. So now they're going to go back, fix that, allow these people to go back and get the crack cocaine sentences they really should have gotten back in 2010.
Okay. If you've got questions for Adam Bates or Molly Gill, you can tweet those using the hashtag Cato Connects, and we'll get to those questions as soon as we can. Now, there are differences between the bills in the Senate and the House. What is just in the Senate bill?
Sure. The Senate bill also includes a large prison reform component, which is very important to Senator John Cornyn, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Again, this, you know, right-left agreement. Essentially, this would create more programming in prisons to help prisoners rehabilitate themselves. It would allow some prisoners, not all, but some, to complete these programs and get time credits that at the end of their sentences they could cash in for time on a different form of confinement. So less time in a prison cell, more time in a halfway house or on home arrest, home confinement. There's also some components that would restore juvenile parole for certain juvenile offenders and allow some juvenile offenders to get their records expunged and put their youthful indiscretions behind them.
Now, what does that mean for a young person? I mean, in general, a felony conviction or something, what does that mean for a young person to have that go away?
It means a lot. It could mean, I mean, the burdens of having a felony conviction are enormous. It can make it harder for you to get into college, can make it hard for you to, hard or impossible for you to get college scholarships. It can, of course, make it very difficult for you to get employment. Later on, you can have trouble getting housing, certain federal benefits if you have a felony record. Really, the consequences of having a felony record go on and on and on throughout the course of one's life.
All right, Adam Bates, on, you know, we talked about federal reform a lot, but the overwhelming majority of prisoners in the United States are at the state level. So what have states been doing in the recent years to sort of deal with the fact that there have been these substantial problems with overcrowding and long sentences?
Well, we're starting to see, as you said, the vast majority of people in prison or jail are at the state level. In the past few years, we have seen reform efforts in some somewhat surprising places like Texas. Where I believe they don't have mandatory minimums at the state level in Texas, and they've been able to reduce their population. You've also seen the recategorization of felonies to misdemeanors in places like California that has led to drastic reductions in the prison population. And in several states, you're starting to see a movement in favor of drug legalization, which is, of course, something that Cato and libertarians have supported for a long time to try and limit the number of people who are going into prison in the first place to kind of short circuit these back end problems that you have with what to do with them while they're in and once they get out.
Is there a partisan breakdown to those state level reforms? That is to say, states that are very Democratic or very Republican, is one state or another more likely to engage in that kind of reform?
Not that I've seen. I think regardless of your political philosophy, everybody kind of agrees there's a problem here, and that's why we're seeing the bipartisan efforts at the federal level, and we're also seeing bipartisan efforts at the state level. For instance, New Mexico has abolished civil asset forfeiture, which is a very abusive law enforcement program. That passed unanimously in New Mexico, 98-0 through the legislature, and was signed by the Republican governor. And as I said, Texas is kind of a bellwether Republican state where you're seeing these criminal justice reforms, and you have organizations like Right on Crime and the Texas Policy People doing that work. And then California is a bellwether liberal Democratic state. So whether you're looking at this as a budget issue, as a liberty issue, as a social justice issue, I think the requisite foundation is there for reform, regardless of who you are.
Let's talk about mens rea a little bit, because that's something that does have a component where there are groups of people that are aligned ideologically who do and do not want to see that kind of reform of a requirement of a knowledge that what you're doing is illegal, mm-hmm. which is like that's the foundation of criminal law. But so where are we seeing that, and what has brought that issue? What's made that an issue?
Well, I think it's been the involvement of a lot of different groups. Probably the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has actually been sort of holding the torch on this the longest. And recognizing that there are a lot of laws, whether they're actually in the statutory code or they're regulations set by a regulatory agency and not by Congress, where people either there is no intent requirement, people don't know what the intent requirement is. And sometimes people are breaking the law without realizing they're actually breaking the law. And there's a criminal penalty attached to this, and it's a regulation you don't even know exists. And that's a big concern to many Republican members of Congress. Bob Goodlatte is, I'm told, planning on introducing his own mens rea bill in the House. Senator Hatch, Orrin Hatch from Utah in the Senate, has his mens rea fix to this. And these bills would generally create a default standard so that when there is that vagueness, there's something to go back to and have a level of culpability so that people aren't unknowingly breaking the law and getting punished for it.
All right. Any thoughts on mens rea?
Well, I agree with you that this historically, this is a foundation of the law, that in order for there to be a crime, there has to be a guilty mind and a guilty act. There are far too many laws, and it's far too easy for people to get caught up in this system through no fault of their own, really. Two good examples, at least in the, this is in the gun context, but Brian Aitken and Shanine Allen. Shanine Allen was a single mother from Philadelphia. She had a concealed carry permit. She drove across into New Jersey under the impression that her concealed carry permit was, she didn't have to get a new driver's license to go across the border. And she was arrested there and sentenced and convicted. Even as somebody who's interested in firearms and as a lawyer, I have trouble navigating these laws when I try to figure out what crimes are in various places. And we have a serious mens rea problem in this country where we have this kind of one size fits all. And this is especially a problem with mandatory minimums as well, where we go after this kind of uniform justice system to remove discretion from the situation. But when you do that, you have people get caught up in this who shouldn't be there and who the laws were never intended for.
Now, your organization, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, of course, there are no elimination of mandatory minimums in the legislation that is most likely to become law this year, next year, or 2017. But let's talk about how mandatory minimums actually function within the context of a prosecution. Mm-hmm. What does a mandatory minimum do to the defense? What does it do for prosecutors? And how does it alter how juries do their jobs? Mm-hmm.
Well, a mandatory minimum essentially shifts all the power, all the sentencing power from the judge over to the prosecutor. And it literally turns your prosecutor into your judge, jury, and executioner. The prosecutor goes into a closed room, it's not a public process, and he decides what to charge you with. And that can include a very harsh mandatory minimum sentence, which means that right there, your prosecutor has also chosen your punishment. When you go to court, the prosecutor will often say, this is what I've charged you with, and if you don't play ball with me, if you don't turn in other people to me, this is what you're going to face. Now, there is certainly nothing wrong with people pleading guilty and confessing that what they're doing, but there's a fine line between cooperation and coercion, and mandatory minimums can lead to abusive government power. Mandatory minimums also, if you do plead guilty, if you are convicted, now this judge is faced with, I have to give you 10 years. And it doesn't matter if that 10 years is nonsense and makes no sense and doesn't fit your crime. It doesn't matter if there is a mens rea issue in the case and maybe you didn't actually do what they say you intended to do. Now you are going to prison for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, life without parole even for drug offenses, for nonviolent drug offenses. It's where they're most often used. They're often used in the gun possession context as well.
All right. And when we talk about that, Weldon Angelos is the case that has been highlighted several times. Mm-hmm. This is somebody who, because he possessed a gun during a drug crime, didn't use the gun, mm-hmm. didn't brandish the gun, but he had it. Mm-hmm. And that's what contributed so mightily to his sentence. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Weldon sold marijuana 3 times in a short period of time to an undercover officer. The first time he had a gun in an ankle holster, didn't use or fire it or point it at anybody. The second time, the gun was left in his car during the sale. The third time happened when they came to his house to arrest him and they found guns locked in his safe. Weldon, lifelong gun enthusiast, target shooter, and he ended up getting 5 years for that first gun, plus an additional 25 for the second, plus 25 for the third. 55 years total, first-time offender. His judge was so upset by this that he gave him just a day for the marijuana charges and wrote a 97-page opinion saying, I would have given more time to a terrorist, a child rapist, an airline hijacker than I have given to this young man.
In the context of how prosecutors and defense attorneys do their jobs, plea bargaining is overwhelmingly popular. As I understand, like 3% of cases go to trial.
That's correct.
Criminal cases go to trial. How do mandatory minimums actually figure into that process?
Well, I think prosecutors would tell you we need mandatory minimums to get guilty pleas. But actually, that tune is starting to change, even at the Department of Justice. The Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, who oversees all the trial prosecutors, recently said, you know what? We actually don't need mandatory minimums to get people to plead guilty. Guess what? Pretty much everybody pleads guilty all the time, no matter what you're charged with. And that's true. Plea rates are very high, 97% or above, pretty much across the board in the federal system. And they're very similar in state systems. And I think that shows you, that says a lot about how harsh our sentencing has become. In the federal system, it's basically go to jail, go directly to jail. You're not going to get probation except in a very tiny sliver of cases. People plead guilty because they are guilty. They plead guilty because they can't afford to fight the system. They plead guilty because they are looking at just such a tremendous amount of prison time. It doesn't matter if there's a mandatory minimum or not.
Right. And I think the prosecutors are often overlooked when it comes to things like mass incarceration and how we ended up here. I do think the drug war is a part. Sentencing is a part. But mandatory minimums I don't think this was the intent of mandatory minimums. The idea was to take some of the discretion out of the justice system and have a uniform system. But because of how this criminal justice system actually works, it then became incumbent on the prosecutor to decide what to charge you with, and therefore they could determine your sentence instead of having the legislature do it. So it was another lever for the prosecutor, but we already have a very, what I would call, a coercive plea bargaining system. So I think you're right, that even in the absence of mandatory minimums, we would still have a plea bargaining problem. We would still have a problem of overwhelming majority of criminal defendants waiving their rights to trial in exchange for a lower sentence. So yes, I think the mandatory minimums played a big part in boosting the leverage that prosecutors have in this process.
All right. So at the state level, where do mandatory minimums stand for the broad range of states?
Well, I think we're in the middle of an ongoing rejection of these laws across the country. And there are a number of red states that have done multiple reforms recently to either eliminate these mandatory minimums entirely or to create exceptions to mandatory minimums that restore flexibility to judges. So Georgia, for example, has done several batches of safety valve reforms. That these are exceptions that give judges flexibility around mandatory minimums. Maryland just passed one. Oklahoma just passed one. The American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a sort of conservative group that FAM is a part of, they've adopted a model safety valve that has been promoted in many states across the country. Pennsylvania right now is in the middle of sort of reassessing its mandatory minimums because they all got struck down as being unconstitutional. And FAM's working there to sort of remind them, you know what, you don't have to have mandatory minimums. And in fact, your sentencing commission has said you shouldn't. So let's just not readopt them. And we are working in the state legislature there on that. So I think, again, sort of a, you know, blue states, red states, purple states, 30 states have reformed their mandatory minimum sentencing laws in the last 10 years. And in all of those states, crime has continued to go down. So we are learning we don't need mandatory minimums to be safe.
All right. On the issue of marijuana and drug crime generally at the state level, have substances other than marijuana been receiving reduced penalties for people who are convicted of possessing or dealing them?
Well, I do think we're starting to see a push in this direction, especially when it comes to heroin. You will often hear about this heroin epidemic that could have something to do with government crackdowns on pain management doctors. But I think people are starting. There are so many people who have been put through the criminal justice process as a result of the drug war that virtually everybody knows somebody who's been part of this process. It's starting to affect a much wider range of communities. This is especially true of this rise in heroin use. So yes, I think we're going to start hopefully seeing some pushback. Probably not. Legalization is probably too optimistic. on things like cocaine and heroin, although the same logic applies to that applies to the argument for the legalization of marijuana. But
and arguably stronger, depending on what you're
And especially, yes, as far as neutralizing the incentives for the cartels and correcting problems in the criminal justice system. But the heartening thing is that we're having these conversations. You can talk about reducing penalties for cocaine and heroin. You can talk about legalization in serious company and have a serious discussion about this, where only a few years ago, I don't think there could have been a serious discussion about this.
What has changed in states like Colorado and Washington and now Oregon and Alaska and Washington, D.C.? What has changed with respect to marijuana and crime and crimes that are often associated with drugs?
Well, it's a little too early to tell in some areas, such as D.C. And D.C. is in kind of a regulatory limbo because of some federal congressional intervention by the Republican Party, interestingly, to kind of meddle in D.C. pot legalization. But at least in Colorado, which legalization went into effect January 1st, 2014, there have been drops in there have been a substantial drop in marijuana crime, obviously, but there have been drops in property crimes, violent crimes, traffic fatalities. It's been a huge boost to the revenue of the state, and the predictions of a gigantic spike in use simply haven't come true. There has been observed in surveys a modest increase in admitted pot use, but it's always difficult to tell with polls. I think people may be more likely to admit to doing something that once it's legal than admit to doing an illegal drug. So the concerns of the drug warriors have not come to pass in any of these places. There's no serious movement to go back. Which I think is probably the best indicator of how it's worked, is that there's no serious push to undo the legalization efforts in these places. Legalization recently failed in Ohio, but there's a lot of reasons to think that had more to do with the cronyist regulatory framework than the merits of the issue itself. But this is something that's going to keep moving. States like California, Nevada, New York, Massachusetts, in the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see a lot of states go down the legalization route, and that's very heartening.
Molly Gill is Government Affairs Counsel at Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and Adam Bates is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and watch our other events at cato.org.